just off the 101 freeway in the shade of the California live oaks. Explore and picnic in the gardens before the show. Further information available at www.seatricum.com and at kpfk.org.
KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. We live in a global world. We are all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the relationship between art and politics. Now to news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. Filings for unemployment benefits fell last week to the lowest level in 10 weeks as U.S. layoffs remain historically low. The Labor Department reported today that the number of Americans applying for jobless aid in the week ending July 11th dropped by 8,000 to 208,000. That's well below the 219,000 new applications forecast by analysts surveyed by the data firm FactSet. Weekly filings for unemployment benefits are considered a proxy for layoffs and are close to a real-time indicator of the health of the U.S. job market. The total number of Americans filing for unemployment benefits for the previous week ending July 4th fell by 16,000 to 1.81 million. The U.S. government has designated two new Mexican cartels as foreign terrorist organizations. The Juarez cartel on the Texas border and Los Viagras from Michoacan join six other Mexican criminal groups with this label. The Federal Register published the designations today. President Trump began labeling Latin American cartels as terrorist groups in February of last year. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said these groups pose serious threats to U.S. security. The move increases pressure on Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum's administration. The Juarez cartel controls a key border crossing, while Los Viagras operates in Michoacan producing synthetic drugs. The U.S. military expanded its airstrike campaign against Iran to targets beyond the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has retaliated with missile strikes on neighboring Gulf states. Ben Thomas has more.
Tehran says U.S. strikes have killed more than 35 people in recent days and wounded more than 300.
I had to take tough action because they did not obey what they're supposed to obey. I mean, they just didn't do it.
But at the U.S. Army War College in Pennsylvania Wednesday, President Trump insisted Iran is looking to strike a deal.
They want to settle so badly. They don't like what we're doing.
But that interim deal to end the war appears to have been shredded. I'm Ben Thomas.
President Trump is scheduled to address the nation this evening on topics he says will include elections and voting machines. This suggests he could revisit long-debunked conspiracy theories about his 2020 loss to Democrat Joe Biden. The speech comes as he's escalated his calls for Republicans to pass tighter federal voting rules ahead of November's midterm elections. At Trump's last primetime presidential address in April, he said the U.S. would accomplish its Iran war objectives, quote, very shortly. But days of back-and-forth attacks by the U.S. and Iran across the Middle East and in the Strait of Hormuz have shredded the interim deal to pause the fighting. Trump has long claimed that the 2020 election was rigged against him. He's yet to provide any evidence to support his claims. An Associated Press analysis shows Americans are waiting longer for disaster aid under President Trump, with delays often lasting weeks or months. The report shows Trump is taking longer to approve major disaster declarations than any other president since 1989. Trump also has been denying more requests during his second term. The AP's analysis shows those denials are disproportionately hitting states that didn't support Trump politically. Trump has nominated Cameron Hamilton to become director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. Cameron has said he wants to speed up disaster declaration decisions and ensure that reviews are objective and fair. The New York Times has filed a motion to quash subpoenas that the Justice Department served on journalists who reported on security concerns involving the new Qatari-gifted Air Force One. This sets up a significant court fight over press freedom and the government's ability to force reporters to identify sources. The filing was made under seal Wednesday in the Southern District of New York, where the journalists were summoned in subpoenas delivered last Friday to testify before a grand jury. A new poll in the race for California governor shows Democrat Javier Becerra leading Republican Steve Hilton by a huge margin, 61% to 36%. The Public Policy Institute of California conducted the poll. It surveyed more than 1,500 Californian adults from June 29th through July 9th. Those are the Pacifica headlines. I'm Max Pringle.
Those were the news headlines from Pacifica Radio. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy. Today on Sojourner Truth, we talk with Dr. Andra Gillespie on the Trump regime's escalating attacks on election integrity and professor and immigrant rights activist Victor Narro on the ICE murders of Lorenzo Salgado Araujo and Juan Sebastian in Texas and Maine. All this and more on Sojourner Truth Radio. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy. This week, the Trump administration escalated its attacks on election integrity. The regime announced an almost all-white male, a new class of attorneys in the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division and decimated the election committee responsible for assisting states with their elections. The administration publicly suggested that the elections of Senators Warnock and Ossoff of Georgia were fraudulent. Trump and the Senate Republicans continue with the nomination processes and confirmations of election deniers as candidates to oversee elections coming up in November and beyond. And they pushed even more lies in a rambling speech given by the president on Thursday night. How much danger, folks, are we in? Joining me now to talk about what is happening right now with the attack on election integrity is Dr. Andra Gillespie. Professor Andra Gillespie is Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the James Weldon Johnson Institute of the Study of Race and Difference at Emory University. She specializes in political leadership, civil rights, and elections. Greetings, Dr. Gillespie. Thank you so very much for coming on with me today.
Thank you for having me.
So it's like, I don't know, it's like a swoosh, you know, all of a sudden time travel. They have done so much attack in advance with respect to the electoral process and voting this election that's coming up in November. And I want to go through just a little bit with you because I think it's important for people to understand what is happening. So I think it would be good to first start with what may be obvious to some of us, but I think for others may not be that obvious in terms of what seems to be this administration's focus on dealing with this November election and throwing up some barriers with regard to the election. So just off top, a couple of things that you're seeing that you find to be concerning.
Well, there are a number of things that have happened that have been attempted that I in general would find concerning. So the first thing is President Trump's foreshadowing of the fact that elections are rigged. So making allegations about rigged elections for 2026 in advance of the midterm elections. We could look at some of the aspersions that he cast on California's voting process. So in particular, thinking that there is some rigging involved with Spencer Pratt coming in third place in a majority overwhelmingly Democratic city in a first round mayoral election. So there's just the general sort of idea of not taking election results seriously, always calling them into question when you don't get the results that you want, and foreshadowing this idea that he's going to call the 2026 elections into question if he doesn't see his desired result. This is in part concerning because he did the same thing in 2020. So he was already casting a shadow about whether or not the election results were going to be trustworthy in the summer of 2020, even before we got to Election Day. So it seems like he's actually following a similar playbook now. Then there are the other things that have happened. So the first thing we could look at is the plan to redistrict to try to get more Republican seats out of certain states in the hopes that that would offset the potential losses that he might have in swing districts across the country that could actually swing control of the House of Representatives, in particular towards the Democrats in the election. And that was only abetted by the Supreme Court decision in Louisiana v. Calais, which removed in states that were covered by the Voting Rights Act, the opportunity to be able to make claims that redistricting might be racially motivated. And so you could see as what happened in Tennessee is that as soon as the Calais decision was rendered, the Tennessee legislature completely took their one Democratic district, which was a majority Black district, and they divided those voters up into three new districts. So with the hope that there will be no Democrats in Tennessee's legislation or congressional delegation starting next year. So we can see that that's happening. Then we could look at some of the things that President Trump has tried to do, some of which are, you know, being litigated right now and have been enjoined, but, you know, trying to say that the Postal Service won't deliver mail in states that don't turn over their voter rolls to the Justice Department, coming up with lists of citizens so that they can be checked to make sure that there aren't people who are non-citizens who are voting in elections. We could look at basically his dismantling of the Election Assistance Board. We could look at the creation of this task force that is looking at voting administration that's probably providing the evidence that President Trump is going to use in this primetime address that he's about to make. And so as disclosure, we're taping this before President Trump's talk where he's going to make all kinds of claims about elections. So and then there is still you could look at even in congressional hearings where especially in the Senate, where presidential appointees are having to go through confirmation hearings. And these nominees never say that Trump lost the 2020 election. They give this very kind of convoluted answer about ballots that were cast in the Electoral College and Joe Biden won the Electoral College. And so therefore he was instituted as president without actually saying Joe Biden won that election fair and square. So there are all of these things that I think any one of them is concerning, but when you put them all together, they're really concerning.
When you line it up like that, I'm like, goodness gracious. And that's not even everything, as you pointed out. And I really appreciate you bringing up that election here with Spencer Pratt, because I, you know, was talking to one of my great friends, political commentator, journalist, Jasmine Kanick, and we were talking about the race. And, you know, I was saying, what's going to happen is he's just going to use this. Like, he knows Spencer Pratt is going to lose. Come on now. That doesn't make any kind of sense that he's going to win. But he's going to, the regime is going to use this. Trump is going to use this to say, hey, there's some kind of fraud. And because California, and particularly LA County, has such fair rules around voting, right? Like, we don't have voter ID laws. We don't have, you don't have to go to a polling place. You can go to a voting center. We do have support for people that have accessibility needs. We do have more languages, not as many as we'd like on the Black immigrant side, but we do have more languages than we do in some other country. I mean, some other states, excuse me, when it comes to voting. And so I was like, yeah, we gonna hear this again. We have not heard the end of the Spencer Pratt debacle. So really glad that you bring that up. Do you think that this is something that may come back later, even though the mayoral aspect of that is over?
I wouldn't be surprised if President Trump brings this up in his particular speech. I might disagree with you on some things. I think California takes too long to count their ballots. And so given the size of the state, they probably need to start pre-counting ballots ahead of time, even if you don't release the numbers, because when it takes weeks, right, it does actually, in this particularly charged environment, open oneself up to criticisms that something is amiss, even though there isn't anything that is amiss in elections. But, President Trump has been grasping at straws for the last 6 years. So I think he would try to use anything as evidence of, you know, what he is committed to, instead of allowing the data to kind of tell him what's going on and then kind of adjusting one's beliefs accordingly. He already knows what he thinks. He's just looking for confirmation.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy, in conversation with Dr. Andra Gillespie about the Trump administration's escalating attacks on election integrity as we move toward the November elections.
Hi, this is Lila Downs. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, globally on kpfk.org.
Si porque te quiero, quieres llorona.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy. Thinking about when the administration went to Georgia, went to the Secretary of State ostensibly and just grabbed up voter roll documents, didn't give people a chance to copy, which, again, wearing my movement attorney hat, a subpoena doesn't mean you get to grab everything right then and there. But that's how they've been rolling. And actually, you know, looking at what happened with the Ohio Organizing Collaborative, the organization that engages in voter registration in Ohio, a swing state. And you saw, again, the targeting of the 2020 information, both in Georgia and with the Ohio Organizing Collaborative. You see threats that had come out in the D.C. paper from the president that he would declare that the wins of Senator Warnock and Senator Ossoff are actually not wins, that they're illegitimate senators that aren't supposed to be there. It just really harkens back in my brain to like Jim Crow talk, post-Reconstruction talk. Why should people be concerned about these attacks on the integrity in the way that they're being done? Because it's almost like the way this administration moves is like they prove a thing by doing a thing. They come and move against people or say things, and that's how they make it real.
You know, the thing that I worry about is that people might not be discerning. And I think that there is this kind of break stuff and then see if you have to apologize for it later policy that casts aspersions. But it puts stuff out in the ether that then may be really difficult to walk back and get corrected, because other people are engaging in confirmation bias and they'll just stick to a narrative that they like, even if it gets disproved later. There is the harassment element of what's going on here. But then there's also, you know, one of the things that I am looking out for in anticipation of the speech is whether or not President Trump tries to use the executive branch to usurp power over elections that has been constitutionally delegated to the states, and does so in a way that he doesn't get checked. Now, these, you know, state attorney generals are, you know, often suing and getting things kind of stopped in court immediately, but just kind of using this as a pretense to a possible takeover of elections in a way that I would view as problematic and anti-democratic. is something that I would definitely be concerned about. As somebody who lives in Georgia, you know, one of the, you know, things that I think about is that if President Trump tries to challenge the validity and the qualifications of our senators, one of the things that we do have in our favor kind of since Reconstruction is that there's case law that does say, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that basically it is up to Congress to determine who is qualified to be a member. And those qualifications are presented on January 3rd before you take your oath of office. If they're accepted at that time, then you are sworn in and you take the oath of office and you get to be a representative or you get to be a senator. So I think that there is this legal question that we should not have to ask, but that we might have to ask about whether or not if some information comes out later, can you have your credentials revoked? What the sort of my understanding of what the prevailing kind of practice is that if somebody comes forward and let's just say they presented qualification papers, they were sworn in, but then you find out some stuff about them later, then you have to go through an expulsion process. And that expulsion process is directed by the members of the Senate. So we just had an example of that a few years ago with Congressman George Santos. Nobody is disputing whether or not he got more votes in his congressional district than anybody else. But when they found out that he was lying about his credentials and that he was basically a con man, then Congress acted and then they started to, you know, put expulsion hearings into place. And that's how he got booted out. So I think the question here for Senators Ossoff and Warnock is this is a harassment. It is completely unnecessary. But I think it's a question of are there enough votes in the Senate to start expulsion hearings against them? And I think that that really kind of comes down to what type of intestinal fortitude do Republicans have to stand up against specious data and information should President Trump try to levy it against both of these senators? I think the other thing that I will say as a Georgian is this is an example of President Trump not taking responsibility for his own actions. By the numbers, one did not expect that John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock were going to win their runoff elections. They shouldn't have, actually, by the numbers in the state, other than the fact that people were really mad in 2020. And that's part of the reason why Donald Trump lost the state in the presidential election. But Donald Trump, the day before the runoff election, spoke at a rally in favor of the Republican candidates, Senators Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue. And he kept on talking about election fraud and saying that people's vote doesn't count and basically implying that it wasn't worth it to vote. So surprise, surprise, when Republican voters heeded that call and didn't show up to vote the next day. That's how John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock got elected. So I think he bears a lot of responsibility for the fact that Georgia has two Democratic senators. We also have to remember that even if, and like this is complete garbage, but even if Senator Warnock was elected under fraudulent circumstances in 2020, he had to run for re-election in 2022, where he won. And nobody is disputing that. And he won in a year where Republicans won other states. And the reason why he won was that Donald Trump endorsed a really, really bad Republican candidate to run against him. So again, even if you wanted to say that, I don't see how you could push Senator Warnock out of office because he won another election in the intervening 6 years that says he is the duly elected senator from the state of Georgia.
Yeah, and the thing that's so interesting is that it's such an obvious pick and choose of when there's fraud, because do you not have the House? Do you not have the Senate? Do you not have, you know what I mean? It's like, give me a break. When does this fraud start and when does this fraud end? It's so interesting. You have places where you have Democrats, yes, getting elected for senator, and then you have governors getting Republicans getting elected for governor. So which part of the ballot is splitting up into the fraud and which part of the ballot is splitting up into the legitimate? You know, when you sit and think about it, it's completely illogical. But as you said, if you keep saying things over and over again, there are some people who can be swayed. Thinking also about the announcement that the DOJ will be sending attorneys out to help to monitor quote unquote elections. It's not actually so unusual, but rescue me if I'm wrong about this, for the DOJ to have folks on the ground to make sure that things are moving the way they're supposed to move. I have a feeling, Dr. Gillespie, that that is not what the intention is here, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I mean, you're right that U.S. attorneys have been involved in elections in other places. I can remember when I first started doing research in Newark, New Jersey. I wrote my first book about Senator Cory Booker when he was running for mayor of Newark. And Chris Christie, the former governor of New Jersey, happened to be U.S. attorney in the Northern District of New Jersey at the time. And there were allegations about election tampering, not with respect to ballots, but just other types of campaign intimidation. And so the U.S. attorney's office did, in fact, send lawyers to Newark just to be on call in case anything happened. So it's not unheard of for this to happen. But I think the question is, you know, is the DOJ and the FBI and other things going to be deployed in ways that might not necessarily adhere to the letter of the law, and certainly don't adhere to precedent in ways that could be thought about to go on fishing expeditions to harass and intimidate people, and to otherwise just cast a specter that might be frightening to some voters who, you know, maybe aren't used to voting all the time and might make it easier for them to say, you know what, this is an election that I would be willing to stay out of. And so, I think that this sets a tone that's actually really, really important. And so people have to be prepared and they have to steel themselves to exercise their right to vote despite whatever dirty tricks or shenanigans may be going on.
And how do we deal with the potential of having, for example, ICE, Customs and Border Patrol, federal agents, mass mercenaries, folks that Baji, Black Alliance for Just Immigration refers to as the body snatchers? How do we deal with them potentially being at the polls? Because I know there are a lot of folks in immigrant communities, particularly Black, Brown, Asian, Indigenous immigrant communities that are concerned. Like, they're excited about voting. For some of them, voting in the United States is the first time they've ever voted, right? We have new voters that are, you know, including folks that are citizens that, you know, they are not immigrated, aren't naturalized. I have long roots and generations in this country that are, you know, just turned 18, just going to be able to vote. And the thought of having to run through a gauntlet of armed and sometimes masked people who may be asking for IDs, et cetera, very frightening to folks. Is that something that, again, is normal? Are there places where this has happened in the past in the United States? And is this something that people should be concerned about?
Well, what I would tell people is that I hope it doesn't come to that. But people need to be prepared for any eventuality. And, you know, what I would tell communities, especially Black communities, is people have been through things before. Our community has built up a remarkable resilience. This has to be your Ruby Bridges moment. If you think about the Norman Rockwell painting or even the camera footage of Ruby Bridges as a six-year-old having to walk into school with federal agents so that she could go to class, even though for that first year she was basically, you know, alone, everybody has to steel themselves. And I think part of this is preparing people on how to care and conduct themselves in this situation. So part of this is making sure that if you live in states where there are voter ID laws, that you have all of your documentation, that you plan ahead so that you know exactly where you're supposed to go. So I live in a state where out-of-precinct voting is illegal on election day. So you have to know for sure that you're going to the right place on election day, that you have all of the materials that you need. I hate that we are at a point in the United States where people might have to go to a poll armed with a passport or a birth certificate if that's what it's going to take for them to be able to cast their ballot. But we also operate under these rules of standing. And so you actually have to have been injured in order to be able to bring a lawsuit. So if this is people's ill intent, and, you know, I don't know yet whether it is or it isn't, we can't say that something is underfoot unless it actually happens to us. So you hope that it doesn't happen, but you prepare for the worst in case it does. And so part of the voter education strategy this year is telling people what to do, where to go, what documents to bring with you. By the way, here is the number of the civil rights group, of the election protection number if anything happens. As long as you're standing outside of a polling place, if something is happening, people need to be prepared to bear witness and post it so that people are able to tell the story. We hope that nothing happens. For most people, nothing will happen probably. But if it does, everybody just needs to be prepared that they might need to exercise a few extra citizenship rights in order to be able to bear witness to this so that we can try to stop this and correct it. But you're not in the game if you're not there and if you're not participating. And in particular, if you're not voting, you, even if you think you're in a safe district and your candidates are going to be fine or you know who the winner is going to be, you don't want to risk electing people who think that this is okay. And so it's important for you to show up in your district to kind of like at least get your voice out there in this small way of being able to say that these are not the types of behaviors, practices, and laws that we agree with, and don't do this in our name.
Thank you so very much, Dr. Gillespie. Very, very important. Folks, I hope you heard those last points. They were many, but they were pointed. They were important. We want to make sure that people are not intimidated out of their rights, that people do not comply in advance before they even have been told that they can't do something. We want to make sure that folks do our part in order to keep this democracy, get it on its feet and get it going and expand and improve. But let's get it off of life support. Thank you so very much, Dr. Gillespie. Really, really appreciate you.
Thank you.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. And that was Dr. Andra Gillespie talking about the Trump administration's escalating attacks on election integrity as we move toward the November elections. More Sojourner Truth with our conversation with the good Dr. Victor Naro after this short break.
Dignity can save you or kill you. Dignity, I wanna hold on to you. Dignity can hurt you or heal you. Dignity, I wanna hold on to you. Were you there yesterday when the gunman shoot men down? No retreat, no surrender. If them push you, no fall down. Many come, many go. We know the sleepy day for all.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. ICE murdered two men over the last 7 days, bringing the total number of people killed directly by ICE over the past year or so to 11. Of course, that does not include the other almost 40 people killed in ICE detention. Lorenzo Salgado Araujo was killed in Houston, Texas, by ICE body snatchers while on his way to work. Juan Sebastian was in his car just living his life before the ICE body snatchers took it away in Maine as he was driving. The men's families and communities have expressed their outrage, have poured into the streets, prompting protests and vigils across the country. I'm joined now by frequent guest and my comrade, Victor Naro. Victor Naro is the project director of the Labor Center at UCLA, a professor of public interest law at the University of California, Los Angeles Law School, and a longtime organizer and advocate for immigrant and labor rights. Greetings, Victor. Always great to speak with you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me on, Ananda. I hope you're doing well.
I am doing well as can be. As long as we're here, still fighting, We're doing good in spite of all that's happening around us. And of course, wanting to talk with you, you know, when I first heard about Lorenzo Arriagu, I was thinking to myself, my goodness, you know, it's the escalations, you know, you see how they're escalating, and you can almost predict when they're going to kill someone because they're not being stopped from what they're doing. And then not even be able to catch our breath before we have to deal with Juan Sebastian and what happened with him and his murder. It's like, my goodness, you know, again, impunity, still don't have any evidence that there's any effort on the part of the regime or any arm of the federal government to even speak up in a way that lets the soldiers on the ground know that they need to stop. And so I'm really glad to speak with you about this today. The feeling in the community, in our communities, Black and brown, Asian, Indigenous, immigrant, but also folks who are citizens, what is the energy that you're feeling from people right now?
Well, you know, the first thing, we feel a lot of hurt. I mean, we have a right to feel that pain, right? Because these are two individuals that could represent any one of us. You know, they were both loving family members. Their crime was getting into a car, you know, to engage in their daily lives, their work lives. That was the only crime they committed. This could happen to anybody in this country who's Black and brown. And I think this is a wake-up for us. ICE has become a military police force of this president. He's given them $70 billion to buy a major arsenal of weapons. The FBI under Patel has also become a dysfunctional agency that serves the president now. And I think, you know, I don't think you're safe in this country if you're getting into your car and you're Black and brown. And that should be the wake-up call for everybody, because I just think this president and the media to some extent has normalized this to the extent that we are accepting it. We should not accept this. This president's intent on destroying democracy, destroying our constitutional rights, and he can't get his way by doing it by using the army, which is what dictators would do in other country. He's doing it by creating his own army, his own police force. And it's very dangerous. And I think we need every one of us, because not only if you're Black and brown in this country or you're from the Asian community, but if you're native born white in this country, they'll come after you eventually if you denounce this president, because he's also trying to attack protesters and the media that criticizes him. So I think this is, you know, unfortunately we lose lives, right, when we need to develop the awareness of what's going on. But I think losing these two fathers this week, and the only crime they committed was a guy in the car to engage in the daily activity.
Yeah, you know, Victor, when I think about what we see happening here with ICE and CBP and the mass mercenaries, the federal agents, folks that we at Baji call the body snatchers, and the way they're moving, it really is the worst tactics, the worst aggressions and violence that, you know, folks allowed to be normalized in the context of criminal sanctions, law enforcement, cops, police, state troopers, county sheriffs, etc., and what they were doing with Black people, you know, primarily, but also doing with brown folks, right, on that criminal punishment side. So we see the violations of rights where people are being racially profiled. Well, clearly, this is not the first time we're seeing racial profiling.
9/11, what happened after 9/11 with the Patriot Act and the Homeland Security Act, which created this mess we have right now, it made it legal to engage in racial profiling. It made it legal to engage in surveillance against targeted communities. It legalized surveillance and racial profiling. And, you know, we've somehow come to accept that this is the status quo, and it should not. We need to dismantle what this country has been created, especially since 9/11. And I just think since 9/11, there are many communities of color that have not been safe in this country.
Absolutely. Especially in terms of the surveillance and the surveillance state. And that's just been normalized. The brutality that we see people experiencing when we look at both Señor Lorenzo, Señor Juan, and we see brutality that we, again, have seen against Black people, I mean, since the time of chattel slavery, but clearly, you know, going through Jim Crow all the way up to today with the ways that the police and the police state has been used to violate people's rights, has been used to violate people's property rights, personal rights, violate people's bodies. And I feel like they've taken the worst of all of those things that some of us that have been calling for the abolition of police have been warning about, talking about, screaming about, that this regime has taken those worst policies and have made them like the playbook for ICE. The playbook, like the normal playbook for CBP, the normal playbook for surveillance, and normalized it to the point that they're even said openly that if you do these things that are the worst of the worst, we're giving you impunity. Don't worry.
Yeah, you know that they recruit people and hire people without vetting them. 6 months out in the streets with guns and weapons, and they. You know, they haven't been trained, but I think that a lot of these people should not even be serving in their capacity with weapons. And we see this all the time with police departments. Police departments, police officers, they do killings. When we investigate the case, we find that they shouldn't have been a police officer. I just think there's been no vetting. They're just recruiting people left and right, training them for a few, a month, and just throwing them out in the streets. And, you know, the playbook also is designed that we get, because of the media and the coverage, we get then caught up on, like, we had two killings, but then we start to think, well, these are two isolated incidents. But what's happening every day, like, people are dying in detentions. People are getting sick and dying in detentions. People are getting mistreated and tortured in detention facilities. There are ICE agents everywhere now. If you just go to social media, you see videos, ICE agents brutalizing U.S. citizens, detaining people, dragging them away, not asking them any questions, just taking them away. And this is being caught on videotape. So I just think, you know, the surveillance has deep, the enforcement has become even more oppressive. And I think the Trump administration has built the capacity with all the new, funding and pushes of military hardware to make this a dangerous situation for every one of us.
And I think it's important that people understand that. So I thank you for that point, you know, particularly the last point about it being dangerous for every one of us, because I do think that there is, still in people's minds, this separation between what is happening to these particular immigrants or the people that are this particular so-called race versus, you know, dealing with this particular situation, which is immigration versus others. I mean, in the case of Señor Lorenzo, he was not even the person they were looking for. Okay?
He has never committed a crime. He has been in this country 35 years. He improved his situation well enough to start his own construction company. He was taking his construction crew out to work. So his crime was he was going to work. He was targeted because of the color of his skin. You know, they got that one person, but he looks brown, so they assume he was the person. He was targeted because of the color of his skin, and he was shot and killed because of the color of his skin. We got to start using the word murder. You know, we got to really start. I've been using the word murder. Two loving fathers working hard in this country were murdered this week.
They were absolutely murdered this week. And then there's the adding of the, you know, the cruelty. So it's like adding to the cruelty. You already have the cruelty of the murder in the case of Señor Lorenzo, where they murder him. And when you think about how they not just murdered him, then they took all his belongings and his identification so that when he went to the hospital, he would be a Jane Doe, so that his family members, because they knew he had family members that were concerned about him, looking for him, caring for him, so that they would have a hard time catching up with him.
Yeah.
So they went after a person based solely on racial profiling, murdered the person that was not who they allegedly were going after to begin with. And that's an alleged. Then after they murder the person or shoot the person goes to the hospital, they remove everything from the person. So when they get to the hospital, they will die alone.
Yeah.
As a quote unquote John Doe. Victor. Yeah. The
and it took over 30 minutes for him to even, because of this, it took over 30 minutes for him to get attended to by the hospital staff, you know. In the case of Senor Juan, they shot and killed him. It shot him in the head, killed him on the spot, but they still dragged his body out and tried to handcuff him. This is like inhumanity as worse. It's murder coupled with inhumanity. And it's because of, you know, this president, you see the rhetoric the last couple of years, you know, Haitian people eat dogs, you know, according to the vice president. Everybody who comes to this country is a rapist, a child molester, a murderer that's been cut loose by other countries, you know, by their home countries. People are, you know, the Ethiopian community and other communities are milking the system and creating fraud. You know, the rhetoric that they continue is still in the public or in immigrant communities dehumanizes them to a level that ICE agents feel they can act with impunity and they can do whatever they want because they can get away with it and they don't see them as human beings.
Absolutely. Yeah. Whether it's the Somali, whether it's the Haitians, whether, you know, there's always those attacks that are clearly racial attacks and that goes across immigrants of color. Of course, not the white South Africans. He's happy to see them. They are the all but three refugees that have come into this country since this man has become president have been white people from South Africa. So clearly this is not just about need because they don't need anything. They need to be out of South Africa and the United States.
So this is a danger to all of us because there's also comments that the president's been making about the elections, like having federal agents, whether it be ICE or other agents stationed at polling places. You know, so I think, you know, that's why I think we need to wake up finally to, we haven't felt by now that our democracy is under attack. We should feel it now because, you know, we got the elections coming up. I just seen the foreseen issues coming up with having either ICE agents or other federal agents that stay stationed at polling places. And what do we do at that moment? I mean, do we wait until that happens? Because I think we need to start acting now. And we are, you know, we are fighting. There's protests happening everywhere. People are taking out to the streets, people from different communities. I think it was the Madison, that place in Maine where Senor Juan lived. It's a very close-knit community. Everybody knows each other. So people came out in full force. We are out there fighting. We are out there in the resistance. We're out there fighting back. But we need, it cannot just fall. You know, my frustration with the resistance today is it falls on us. It falls on the activists to carry the burden. I want to see our elected leaders not just express their discontent on a talk show, you know, on a news hour, or a news show. I want to see them out there on the streets. I want to see them also put their bodies on the line to fight against you know, this fascist government. You know, it shouldn't just be, the burden shouldn't just be on the activists. They need to finally, it's good to be a denounce, it's good to be angry, but they need to be out there in the streets with us. They need to also put their careers on the line, you know, in order to fight against what we're encountering today, you know, to save democracy. So we all need to do it together. So it should not just fall on the activist community.
Why do you think that that's not happening, right? So we know that, and I'm focusing right now on the electeds, understanding, of course, we know that they're not going to bring liberation, but they have a role to play in the pushback, in the block, right, of this consolidation of power, of which what we see happening with these body snatchers, you know, that's a part of the consolidation of power effort. So they could be blocking that effort by blocking what we see these body snatchers engaged in. What do you think is stopping them from doing that, from actually really getting involved in the way that we've seen before? Like, we've seen that electeds can do that. They can, you know, put their bodies in front of places. They can intentionally get arrested. They can be right next to us, arm in arm, linked, you know. And why is that not happening?
That's a good question. I hope you can answer that. I think a lot of it, you know, I just think the consciousness is still developing there. I just think elected officials feel they have a position where they feel like where they're at in their position, they could be most effective. This president does not care about political etiquette. And he's even going after elected officials now. He's made it clear that if they're his enemy, he'll target them and he'll go after them. So why do we have to feel like we have to be politically etiquette with them? You know, we should hit the streets. They should join us on the streets. I've seen in movements, you know, and I've seen it in 2000 when the janitors were on strike in Los Angeles. Every elected official was out there getting arrested for striking janitors. You know, there have been parts of our country where elected officials have taken it to the streets and have joined us and be there and join us in holding people accountable and fighting back and resisting. But I feel like my hope is there's a consciousness development maybe taking place, and my hope is it will happen soon, because I think these attacks are going to continue, especially the ICE enforcement. They're heavily armed now. They're very dangerous. I think, you know, I don't know the percentage, but I think a high percentage of ICE agents out there should not even be there, should not be in that position, should not be carrying guns and weapons and other arsenal. It is dangerous. And, you know, my question is, how many more people are going to be killed before we have this full consciousness of everybody, we all need to do something together, because we have so much to lose, I think.
Yeah, as a person who is an abolitionist, I'm like, we don't need any ICE people. We don't need any ICE, whether they got guns or not. We just don't need enforcement. Enforcement is not what we should be doing. We should be doing some welcoming. And it'll be a minute before that happens. Turning now to the people, you know, you've talked about how people are protesting. I know people are doing vigils. There's a call for a national day of action that, you know, later on this month. There's a lot that people are doing. We, as Baji, have a team in Houston, and literally almost every hour of the day, there is something that some coalition of groups are doing. With respect to Senor Lorenzo, we know that with respect to Senor Juan, that there's also things that are happening there, again, almost round the clock. And then we have other people that are engaging in actions across the country. You also work in the area of laborers and workers. Are you hearing anything about, you know, any kinds of strikes, any kind, you know, one day strikes, any calls to target corporations, anything like that that you're hearing at this point with regard to the people's response?
Well, Senor Lorenzo, I think, has really hit hard with what happened to him. It has hit the labor community hard, the labor movement, but also the worker justice movement, because he was a construction worker that really worked himself up to have his own company, and he was going to work. You got killed. You got murdered because you were going to work. So I think that's really been an awakening for us. That we are engaged in, you know, in national calls to action. It's beautiful, the movement. We're all connected. So we're all interconnected so deeply. And we're looking at, you know, the part of the, you know, the elections, we're going to have to be there to safeguard the vote. We got to be there to make sure we don't allow ICE or other federal agents to come anywhere near polling places. So we need to do our part there. But we need to also now begin, you know, we have Labor Day coming up. We have other days coming up where we can get together. We're already talking about next May Day 2027. But, you know, I just think what happened to Senor Lorenzo hits hard, because he was murdered because literally he was going to work at a construction site. So it's, you know, I think it's unfortunately a killing, you know, has to happen for us to start to realize that what's happened to against us, all the attacks is something that's really, we have so much at stake and so many lives are at stake. So I'm hopeful that, you know, the resistance is strong. I'm seeing we all come together. There's vigils, there's all kinds of actions, protests. And I think it's a matter of time. I hope we're like elected leaders and other government officials will join us, you know, in the streets especially. But we need to continue the fight. You know, we can, I just think that the Project 2025 is based on instilling fear and hopelessness. That's why, you know, that the Project 2025, that's the strategy, right? We all feel that fear, the hopelessness, like there's nothing we can do. Because they're also going to start targeting organizations. They already, I'm a member of DSA LA, and they're already going after DSA. They're always using the, we're communists now. We're like a threat. We're the rescue. We're like a threat to capitalism, a threat to democracy. I think they're already starting to align the, what they see as political opponents into these categories where we will be targeted soon. So we need to really all be there together. And the best weapon we always have against what they have is solidarity. And that one's deep in the labor movement. I think that's coming out now, that the essence of solidarity in full force. But we all, the best weapon we have against what they throw at us, all the attacks, is solidarity. And I think that's, we just need to be in solidarity and community with each other.
Thank you so very much, Victor. That is a great way to end. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Appreciate the work that you are doing and appreciate you, again, coming on the show, making sure that we have some things to think about and some things to do.
Yeah, appreciate thank you. And we need to protect KPFK too. So we need to make sure KPFK survives all this.
Thank you. You're right about that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that was Professor, Organizer, and Activist Victor Narro speaking about the ICE murders of Lorenzo Salgado Araujo and Juan Sebastian. And that's our show. I'd like to thank our guests, the Sojourner Truth family, especially my dear sister, Margaret Prescott, our board operator, Coltrane, our producer, Gary Scott, and you for joining us. Let's get together at the same time and place next week for Sojourner Truth Radio. Be well.
Mark your calendars. KPFK Summer Fun Drive officially kicks off on Tuesday, July 21st. We want to keep this drive as short as possible and get right back to the uninterrupted, commercial-free programming you love. But we can only do that with your immediate support. Shorten the drive today. Call 818-985-5735 and press option 2. That's 818-985-5735, option 2. Or skip the phone lines and give securely online right now at kpfk.org/donate. Your radio station. Your voice. Keep it strong. Thank you.
Stranger and wider community.
Support for KPFK is brought to you in part by Catalina's Jazz Club, presenting Omar Sosa and his Cuarteto Americanos on Friday, July 17th, 2026. This evening celebrates the release of their brand new debut album, We Are Not the Headliner. Catalina's is located at 6725 Sunset Boulevard West in Hollywood, one block east of Highland. For further information and tickets, 323-466-2210 or online at at catalinajazzclub.com and kpfk.org.
Soy Gregorio Luque y estás escuchando KPFK 90.7 FM en Los Ángeles, 98.7 FM en Santa Bárbara,